When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode 36 of Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi from the infamous String Dusters, and today we are in the presence of greatness. Stick around for an awesome conversation that I had recently with mandolin bluegrass legend Sam Bush, the one, the only, the GOAT is with us today on ITMB, dropping knowledge, dropping stories, and doing it all in that legendary Sam Bush style. So we got that coming up here in just a few minutes. Quick word about my sponsor this season. Big shout out to Deering Banjos, incredible maker of banjos that range from super high-end, super ornate, beautiful tone, to the best affordable banjo out there. That's the Good Time series. If you're looking to check banjo out, or if it's not your first instrument, the Good Time is your go-to. And they've got this great new series of videos on their YouTube channel, on their Instagram. Deering Live features incredible banjo players from across the spectrum. So you got clawhammer, you got three-finger players, and these are interviews, also some playing, so you can learn a ton from those. And you can also learn a ton from Deering's website, a phenomenal resource for really anyone who's learning banjo. So for all your banjo needs, make sure you check out Deering. Inside the Musician's Brain is also brought to you by Osiris Media. Osiris is the voice of the roots music world in podcast form. Many, many great shows under the Osiris umbrella, including, if you're into fish, I got two for you here, Undermine and the HF Pod. Both cover all the bases. Great hosts, great discussions there, really enjoyable. And also another pod that you should check out, Inappropriate Happiness, hosted by Bass Badass, and she's also been on the pod here, Karina Reichman, and Isaac Sloan is the other host there. And that one is just a fun listen. So check them out. Check out Osiris in general. So many great music podcasts there. You should also check out Americana Vibes. That is the infamous String Dusters record label, and we are working hard to curate and bring together all kinds of great up-and-coming bands, more established bands, and just to put great music out there into the world to bring this community together and bring more attention to all the great roots music that's being created these days. It's really pretty endless. Quick conservation shout-out. I'm doing these. I know this is a music podcast, and this may seem a little bit random to some of you, but this is something that's very near and dear to my heart, something that I feel like is more important now than ever, the issue of conservation, taking care of the natural world. And I know it resonates with this audience, so I want to give a shout out this week to the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust. This is an awesome nonprofit, of course, focused more on saltwater species, more on saltwater habitat, and focused very much on water quality as well. And the cool thing about BTT is they really bring the science to the fight. They've invested a lot in research, and that's a big part of moving the needle. They've accomplished some amazing things. They are very worthy of your support. Check them out, the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust. All right, legend alert here on Inside the Musician's Brain. And, you know, if you could go back in time and tell 18-year-old me that I would not just meet Sam Bush, but actually become friends over the years, make a bunch of music together, well, I don't think I'd believe you. I don't think 18-year-old me would be able to keep it together with that intel. That's how big Sam is. And I thought I would try and sort of put all this in context for you. In my case, when I was falling in love with banjo, it was the Flecktones all day, every day. That was what I was into. And of course, Sam Bush was playing with the Flecktones often back in the day. He was on their album Live Art. He was really a part of that sound, that era, when they had a bunch of different musicians who were essentially taking the place of Howard Levy, founding member, who is now back. And from the Flecktones, I migrated over to Bela's solo albums. So I'm talking about Drive, the Bluegrass Sessions, and of course, Sam was a huge part of these records as well. And can't leave out the seminal album, the Telluride Sessions, featuring basically all those same amazing pickers. We'll get into talking about that in a minute. Put all these records on your required listening list, by the way. So I'm talking about all of Bela's solo stuff, Drive, Bluegrass Sessions, Tales from the Acoustic Planet Volume 1, a favorite of mine, Telluride Session. Any of their solo records usually features some collection of these players. And they were changing the game at that time. And the point of all this is that what I was going through was what many young players were going through, discovering this innovative, amazing new iteration of bluegrass, string band music, whatever you want to call it. And at the center of it all was Sam's ultra distinctive mandolin playing, his thick driving rhythm, his fiery creativity. I mean, you just knew it was him from the first notes. And his sound was such a big part of what shaped our concept, my generation, again, of how the music could sound, of how it was supposed to sound, and how powerful it could be. And of course, this crew, Bela Fleck, Sam Bush, Jerry Douglas, Edgar Meyer, Mark Schatz, Stuart Duncan, Mark O'Connor, Tony Rice, later Brian Sutton, these guys became our musical gold standard. And it was just inspiration in action. And pretty much all the string players that I was around, you know, relatively close in age, we all gravitated toward these legends in the making. And one of the real defining aspects of this generation of players was how they employed all of the bedrock, essential technical aspects of bluegrass that make it so cool, so powerful. So I'm talking about the rock solid timing, the really evocative tones of the instruments, and really precise, but also artful, really soulful articulation that those early bluegrassers pioneered. They had all of that, but they expanded the vocabulary, the lexicon of instrumental ideas, and of course the composition possibilities. They expanded all of that immeasurably, just bringing all these new influences into the music. So everything from jazz, classical, you know, different ethnic music from around the world. They really just blew the whole thing wide open, and in the process inspired legions of young players. And at the center of it all, the rhythmic backbone, was Sam Bush. He was the guy. And that's really saying a lot, because one of the fundamental aspects of their music was that it was string band music. There was no drummer. And to make up for that lack of power, because the drums, the traditional kind of electric rhythm section, that's really what makes almost all popular music powerful, rhythmically powerful. And to make up for that, the mandolin had to really bring it, really fill a lot of space, really have a lot of rhythmic information and a lot of mojo going. And Sam, he answered that call and really set a new standard in that area. He kind of redefined what we thought was possible on the mandolin. Now, of course, the modern day Sam Bush band has had a drummer for years now, and this doesn't take anything away from what Sam is doing. It's just a different sound. And a quick shout out to my man Wes Corbett, Sam's excellent new banjo player who replaced Scott Vestal, sounding awesome. But in that seminal era, and in all that music that I keep referencing, from Drive to the Bluegrass Sessions and everything in between, and even going back to, of course, the Newgrass Revival, Sam Bush was kind of what held it all together. He was the rhythm, and that is no exaggeration. We've been crossing paths with Sam for years now. So many sit-ins with the Dusters. He's even done some more formal kind of like special guest appearances. But the time when I really got you know, my most intimate playing experience to that point with Sam was over two different installments of the Bluegrass Generals. That's a side project that Andy Hall and I do here in Denver, where we bring together lots of different musicians, and Sam was part of the first installment of that. I wonder if any of you were at the one-up to see Larry Keel, Sam Bush, and Sam Grisman joining me and Andy for what was two very memorable nights of music. And for the second installment, we were at Cervantes, and I'll never forget this. So it's like 1 p.m. on a Friday afternoon in this dark, dank green room, and you know, we're getting ready for night one of two nights, four individual sets, no repeats, like a lot of music to learn. And here we are playing a song that Sam's played a million times, and he is giving it 110% full on, like headbanging in the green room, committed. That just always, that really made an impression on me in the moment and really always stuck with me, always resonated as a reminder that the best players never take the music for granted. They practice like they play, and they really mean what they say. And I think that's such a great thing to emulate. Another thing that I loved from this conversation was Sam's answer to my question about how he gets in the zone for shows, how to be a better performer. And of course, I ask a lot of guests that question. I think it's always really interesting. And Sam's answer was so simple, really beautiful, and perhaps something that can seem cliche, even maybe a little trite in sort of this mindfulness information age. But his answer was simply to practice gratitude. And it's just such a simple little trick that can get you out of your own way. Take the attention off your inner monologue, chill out that judgmental energy, and kind of help get you centered on what's really happening, which is always just the present moment. Truly all there is, but we can't be reminded of it enough. And if that's good enough for Sam, well, that's a great reminder of how timeless the practice really is. And it reminds me of an awesome Michael J. Fox quote. I don't know where I saw this, but I just jotted it down on my sort of running list of ideas that I want to share here on Inside the Musician's Brain. And that is, quote, "With gratitude, optimism is sustainable," end quote. And I think that's such a good one. And the world sure needs more optimism. Okay, enough for me. Let's jump ahead now to hear from one of the greatest acoustic musicians of all time. This is Sam Bush. Here we go.
I can't ever seem to get nowhere when I play it out. Close my eyes and I am halfway there. All I carry is this remedy to see you again. So I'm sending out this signal that I'm traveling to you as fast as I can. To the crowded station gate, among the Sundays just to make it through. Another window in this terminal wait. There ain't no easy way to pay these dues, save for these transcendental meditations.
We are here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and my guest today is legend status, and I do not use that term lightly. One of our biggest inspirations, one of our musical heroes, Sam Bush. Welcome to the podcast, man.
Hello, hello, everyone. Hello, Panda. good to see you today.
How are you doing, man?
It's good to be seen.
I assume you're coming to us from Nashville, Tennessee right now.
We are, yes. It's a lovely day outside, of which I, you know, need to get out and spread some seed here in the old yard here after a while. But it's a great day, and just honestly, just getting over Merlefest. We go there every spring, and it's a privilege. I've you know, more than ever, I appreciate it this year, being that it was the 35th one, and I've gotten to go to all of them. And this one also was in commemorative of Doc Watson's 100th anniversary of his birth year. So it was, you know, I used to get to play with Doc and Merle some, and so it, you know, it was really special in a way. I kept thinking more fondly than ever of good old Doc Watson, you know, how much we all owe him.
How cool. What was it like playing music with him?
Well, it was a lesson. There was always a lesson to be learned if you just paid attention.
Amazing.
He led by example. He never said anything, you know, said very few things. But I do know, for instance, the first session I got to be on with him, I'm trying to think, it was in 74. So what would I have been? Still, 22 years old, getting to record with Doc. And the first song we recorded it, and I went in, you know, we go into the control room for listening to the playback, and I must have really been trying hard to impress him and throw in everything I knew in the first song because we listened to it, and Doc just said, son, you know, we're going to play some more songs today.
I love it.
Got it.
Hold something back. Save something for the rest of them.
Yeah, you don't have to play everything you know in the first song. It might work out better for the music, for sure. But he didn't have any limits on music, and so I totally loved that about him. He loved any kind of music. There was no, you know, boundaries in music to him, and he didn't really understand boundaries in music. It didn't really make much sense to him. It all sounded like music to him.
Yeah, that's cool. Little known fact, I have my side project, which is, it's called Trad Plus, and it's this wide-ranging, you know, beats and electronic stuff and banjo, and Stuart Duncan played fiddle on the last record, and me and a drummer, and the name Trad Plus comes from Doc Watson, because I remember looking in the Merlefest program one year, and Doc said back in the day that he referred to his own music as traditional plus. Traditional music plus whatever else I like. And I just thought, man, that's hip.
I mean, man, I was, you know, it was, probably 10 years, probably maybe before Doc died. But I was, I went over to play. Sometimes I'd be hired to come, you know, play sometimes. And I met up with he and Jack Lawrence and I guess Richard Watson over in Memphis. And I'm sitting there playing with him. And, you know, Doc always surprised me. And that night he sang Nights in White Satin, and it was beautiful.
How cool.
And I was bowled over. He said, yeah, Brother Jack taught me this one.
That's really
and,
cool.
You know, it's just a good song. Is it a good song or not? I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of things I want to chat with you about today, Sam. First of all, thank you so much for joining me, man. This is a real honor. And as I said in the intro, you know, you're one of the guys who really set us on the path that we're on, not only the String Dusters, but all of the pickers in my generation. And, you know, we owe you a big debt of gratitude for all the amazing recorded music, everything on stage over the years. It just really has been such a huge inspiration, man. So first of all, thank you. But I also...
My pleasure.
I also wanted to just kind of...
Glad to be in there somewhere.
You know? Well, you're at the front of the whole thing, and we're going to talk about some moments along that path. But I kind of wanted to start by just getting your impression of where acoustic music and Newgrass is today. Because, I mean, the music is just thriving like never before. You could even argue, I would say, that bluegrass is more popular right now than it's ever been, reaching more new fans in the hands of more new players. All that influence that started, you know, back in the 40s and then with you guys has really trickled down. And it's amazing to see. And I just kind of wanted to get your impressions of how the scene has grown and evolved to where it is today.
Well, I think it's in pretty, I tend to think more of it in the, where's the music at? Not so much the ticket sold or the show business part of it, but that's all, you know, part of the popularity. But I mean, the popularity is obviously at a height, or people like us couldn't all go around making a living, right? And right. So there's room for all there's venues for all of us of different types, and then when you think of, you know, and the first thing that comes to mind, of course, for all of us how good Billy's doing, Billy Strings, how good Billy's doing, and that's just gonna, I've always tended to think that's just gonna help all of us. But I, you know, because I've been around long enough. Yes, I have. I remember I was a kid, just maybe, not remembering exactly, but a early teenager, when Foggy Mountain Breakdown came on the radio, and it came on the rock and roll channel in my hometown in Bowling Green. So, you know, every once in a while, something would come along. Something would come along that gave bluegrass a goose, and tradition. And I swear it was almost as if three major times that it happened, it revolved around being in a film. First was Bonnie and Clyde, and that kind of coincided also with Beverly Hillbillies being on TV. And for instance, a young person like a young little Bela Fleck, you know, hears that on TV at his granddad's house and goes, "Whoa!" So. Then the next one that I, you know, really gave a bluegrass a big shot in the arm, totally was on the radio, was Eric Weisberg and Steve Mandel with Doolin' Banjos when Deliverance was a hit movie in the early 70s. And then the most recent one that was gave bluegrass style music a great shot in the arm was, of course, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? So, I mean, you know, the world of film has really helped out. Certain things get on a radio that, you know, otherwise might not have been. So that's been, that's its own kind of goose it's had. And but right now, like if you know, the way Billy's selling tickets, you know, Molly Tuttle's doing great. I mean, there's you know, Sierra's out there playing great. I mean, there's musically speaking, I think it's a great time, but it's been this way for a while. Because you still have Del McCurry, and I just got to sing with Del and Peter Rowan the other day at Merlefest, you know, and I got to thinking about how lucky, you know, though they are still first generation. Hey, if you played with Bill Monroe, you're still first generation bluegrass boy. I mean, you know what? What really kicked both those guys into bluegrass was playing with Bill Monroe, and so we still have Del McCurry. Who, in his mind, is not limited within the way he plays bluegrass. It just sounds that way. It's just the way he is. I mean, it's just natural. And but he's always been bringing in new material and stuff. So it's a young audience is part of where a large part of this equation is being able for a young audience to hang and enjoy this kind of music more than ever. So that's pretty great that if a young audience is picking up on the musicianship of bluegrass style players.
Well, it's an interesting point you make about Del, and you kind of said the same thing about Doc a moment ago, and all these guys, Monroe, Doc Watson, Del McCurry, even though people think of them as more traditional players, it seems like they're kind of the most open-minded guys all along. And it's like this lost sort of element, this lost piece of the puzzle that traditional people get hung up on. And now I feel like we're just seeing the fruits of how open-minded these musicians are. And it's like the floodgates are open. All this new music, all these new styles are coming into bluegrass.
Well, I mean, yeah. And when you think of, I guess as my dad, maybe the first time I would have ever heard this kind of thought was, you know, he was a big fan of the Grand Ole Opry. And so he said when Bill Monroe came on the Grand Ole Opry and played Orange Blossom Special the first time, and this is pretty much pre-Earl Scruggs being in the band, that just him, Bill Monroe, coming on and playing Orange Blossom Special just absolutely tore the place apart. And then, you know, later when he got Earl Scruggs with his fancy banjo, who called it that? Dave Macon, maybe, Earl and his fancy banjo. My dad said that everybody else played old timey, like the Fruit Jar Drinkers and the Possum Hunters, and so, you know, it'd be fiddle tunes and stuff, but with clawhammer banjo and certainly with the way not jug bands, but you know what we now would term old-time fiddle music bands.
Sure.
But anyway, when Bill Monroe came along, it was this new. I mean that might have been your first hillbilly jazz right there.
I love it. Well, and definitely, you know, ahead of his time, these guys, Monroe, Scruggs, just like innovators on another level and creating something out of nothing. And it's so cool. And then years later, Newgrass Revival comes along, and Newgrass started up in 1971. And I often think of you guys as sort of way ahead of your time, because it just, I mean, wouldn't you agree there really wasn't anything like that? And how did that feel when you guys were coming up with this style of music that, you know, was something pretty new?
Honestly, well, I mean, we had our influences, and in some ways we were following a trend that was going along in bluegrass music at that time. I mean, before we got together, for instance, just a couple of years before that, Emerson and Waldron made these great records where when I heard Emerson and Waldron doing Firework Carpenter, that just, oh man, I just thought that was one of the best things I ever heard. Mm-hmm. And so there were, and that, you know, goes back to the Country Gentleman. Even though I'm a large Bob Dylan fan, I was a larger bluegrass fan as a kid. So some of my favorite, you know, some of my first exposure to Bob Dylan songs were by the Country Gentleman. So we kind of went further into like following rock and roll kind of people and stuff. It was, I mean, we had two tapes. We had these two records on a cassette we would drive around and listen to when we first had our band. And on one side of the cassette was John Hartford Aeroplane. And of course, that record. And on the other side was Leon Russell and the Shelter People. And those two records like influenced us just to what we loved to hear, what we loved about rock and roll, what we loved about bluegrass, what we loved about country, everything. And lo and behold, within a few years, we were like, you know, playing alongside of them, both of them.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. It was like crazy how it happened. But we the Newgrass Revival, we were influenced by people that already deviated. So that mold was already set to me. I mean, you know, you had the Osborne Brothers doing wonderful, far out things. Jim and Jesse, you know, I mean, Berry Pick and Time in the Country alone, they did a whole album of Chuck Berry songs. The Dillards, you know, when they introducing orchestration and drums and steel guitars on some of their songs, it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And so the Charles River Valley Boys did that great album called Beatle Country. It was really influential to us youngsters that loved the Beatles and bluegrass. It was the perfect record almost with Joe Val. And and it's no coincidence, on our very first record, a Newgrass Revival, our version of Great Balls of Fire is totally influenced by me watching TV. And Courtney saw the same show, watching the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour, when they had a pickin' segment each week. And the first couple of years, it was Glen Campbell and John Hartford sitting there pickin'. And a bass player, maybe another rhythm player, but I mean, it was just really a great segment, right? There, Glenn could really play, right?
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
Boy, John and Glenn doing this picking segment on network TV. It was wonderful. So one, and I had a little jack on the back of my tape recorder, and I used to tape this stuff. And I don't know where my tape went, but I had a tape of John and Glenn Campbell doing singing a duet of Great Balls of Fire, bluegrass beat. And the very lick Courtney played on our version came from John on that tape. So
cool.
We learned it straight from Hartford, and their old Hartford was influencing us right there.
Well, I think one of the ways that you guys are perceived as sort of being ahead of your time, because obviously all these influences are in play and you can hear them, and you guys did do something very new and continue to push the envelope, but in terms of the way you presented the music, you know, everything from the way that the band looked to the types of shows that you were trying to play, like that was something pretty new though, right? I mean, there weren't you guys probably didn't have a lot to look up to in terms of like bands that were on a certain track playing certain type of venues. It was sort of the wild, wild west, and you guys were kind of making it up out of thin air on that front, right?
Well, I mean, we right off the bat, we weren't really accepted by the Bill Monroe camp. Person that did hire us, Breakfast Special, which was, you know, Tony Trischka and Andy Stapp, mm-hmm. and Kenny Kosek, and the New Deal String Band. So us three hippie kind of bands, Carlton would hire us. But we really did kind of need to make our own audience. And college yeah. audiences were really a good part of our audience, as was John Hartford's in the early 70s. And that it was really, so I started playing music for a living August of 1970. And so, it was up, and we played a lot of colleges because there was a good acoustic music scene kind of happening, thanks to the popularity of, say, James Taylor and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And Hartford was part of that. Glenn Campbell was even part of that. And that was all good until 1976, disco hit. And it killed the folk. There was always like a little coffee house within the college where about a 200 seater. That's kind of where we would play a lot, and we opened for quite a few shows for John Hartford in that situation. And those jobs just went away because the colleges really? Okay. found out they could, once disco hit, they could pack the dance floor and just play a record. And boom, you didn't have to hire a band.
Crazy.
They still hired the rock shows and stuff, but it kind of killed folk music in the old colleges.
So what was the legacy of that? Like, was that a thing that lasted for a few years, and then you noticed that acoustic music kind of came back around, or was that something that really kind of put a damper on things for an extended period of time?
Well, I mean, that was just one. You know, part of where you could work. But there wasn't really a market, be it either country or rock and roll, once that kind of happened. Because even, there weren't new groups getting signed that were playing acoustic guitars anymore in rock and roll, much. And so that's, as we continue to try to make records. I mean, we always loved to try to play country rock. We tried to play rock and roll. We tried everything. And with our instruments. And as far as what you were talking, what we were alluding to earlier, we really were just influenced by the Burrito Brothers, and we did one of their songs, Four Days of Rain. That was, but it took a singer like John to be able to sing it. So some things it was almost like we had to wait to work up till John could join to get a singer that good to sing like that, to have those vocals. And but I think every band goes through this, no matter who you're influenced by. It's the way you happen to play, and it's the way us four could play together. And we really did grow up, Courtney and me, especially really kind of grew up together playing. He was just older than me, but you know, when he first started playing banjo, I mean, he was totally Ralph Stanley. I mean, he didn't play a lick of what I call Scrugg style. He played like Ralph Stanley style, maybe with a little Reno thrown in. And he was the lead singer in the band. Courtney was. So, and then he came back from a folk festival telling me, and this, so this is somewhere around 1968 or 9, or maybe even a little before. Anyway, he went to Folk Festival in Arkansas, and he said, "I just heard the best banjo picker you're ever going to hear." And he's a boy from Oklahoma named Alan Mundy. And you know what? He was right.
That's cool. Well, you guys, you know, regardless of what happened during that time, it's amazing to behold the influence, like I said, that's now really trickled down all the way to us, and now bands like you mentioned, Billy Strings, and there's a million bands out there these days, and you know, these events like Winter Wondergrass that weren't around when we got our start, and it's like, wow, all these amazing pickers are coming out of the woodwork, and a lot of that really started with you. And it's a good segue because you mentioned John Hartford, and you have this awesome new record that came out last year, Radio John, Songs of John Hartford. And I want to talk about that a little bit, but in keeping with this conversation about, you know, Newgrass and the influence, I read or heard you talking in an interview about how there's no Newgrass without John Hartford. And he obviously was a huge influence on you. How would you describe the things in his music, the spirit, the picking, the songs, whatever? What were the things that really influenced you and then, again, sort of stepped into that, you know, like that area that ultimately became bluegrass?
Well, I've said it in some of these interviews in talking about John, but what attracted me, first thing that ever happened, I saw him on TV. We live close enough to Nashville TV. Watching one of the Saturday afternoon programs, I think the Wilburn Brothers show, and there was a guy, good-looking guy, singing lead while playing Scruggs-style banjo. And I never saw anybody do that. I didn't know anybody could actually do that at the same time and actually keep this role going. And so, but I didn't catch his name. So then a few weeks later, my dad and I were in Nashville at the Ernest Tubb record shop, and I was leafing through records, and there's that guy. That's him. His name's John Hartford. So I bought that record, and it happened to have Gentle on My Mind on it. And this was before Glen Campbell came out with that song.
Right.
So immediately, you know, I'm like, I mean, I was a kid that was drawn to everything. So these kind of records that John made for RCA would have, you know, a trap drummer, an electric bass, probably piano. So country style instruments that were, you know, the rhythm section of the day in Nashville. Later come to know Norbert Putman played most of the bass on all those records. And But these interesting songs, while mixed in with a guy that obviously knew Scruggs banjo, but progressive style banjo too,
sure,
and melodic style at a time when not a lot of people played that way. At any rate, I got each time we go back to Nashville, I buy another John Hartford record, and so now I was building it up, and then all of a sudden, boom, he's on TV. Now he's on Glen Campbell show. When I had been seeing him locally around Nashville on TV. So then, yeah, and now he's there, and then that even leads to he played at like the basketball arena at the college when I was a junior or senior
in high school.
I know, because I had to hightail it over there in my muddy halftime band uniform from marching at the football game. Totally fell down, muddied up to the knee, but I made the show.
So you were in the marching band back in the day?
Oh, yeah.
What was your gig there?
Drums. Well, drums. Drama. I graduated to snare. I started as the bass drummer. But I was, as a bass drummer, in the words of Bill Monroe, I was a bit too stout. I was louder than the whole band. It was a 42-piece little band there. I could really hit it.
Not surprised that you started out as a drummer, because we all hear that in your playing.
I did learn, you know, there's certain, you know, basic rudiments.
Yeah.
You know, so the ones go, ba-da-da, ba-da-da, Well, I try to do that for him. But, you know, no, I was a very, very mediocre, but it was enough to let me march with the band and enjoy. It was great fun. Marching band was great discipline. I loved it.
I bet. Well, that's a really cool point you make about Hartford and the whole Newgrass thing, because I feel like the songs is such a big part of it. Like, for example, if you had people playing Scruggs style banjo and mandolin on the offbeat and you played, you know, an Elton John song or a Metallica song, it would sound like bluegrass. You know, it's the playing styles. I always think it's the playing styles and the singing styles that really bring it into that realm. And then when you open up the song craft, you know, which is what guys like John Hartford did, then the music really starts to grow and twist and go in these new directions, which is really cool.
Well, yeah, and in terms of like thinking about where he was heading on this RCA Records, the one before Aeroplane called Iron Mountain Depot, he was stretching out with his four-piece band that still had a rock and roll style bass and drums, but he was stretching out already on that. And then when he got to Aeroplane, these it was like a new style of songs written to play on bluegrass style instruments that like these the way the way John plays rhythm on, like, for instance, Back in the Good Old Days, it's the way he kind of strummed. There was a certain way he strummed. It's halfway between a guitar strum and a frail or so. I don't know what it was, but the way he could do that in certain areas and just, yeah, that you hit it on the head. It's the songs that made these new kind of songs to play and open up our eyes. And even that, it would always be great, like when I get a James Taylor record and there's a song, Riding on a Railroad. Well, John played on that. And that's the way John could fit in his slow, wonderfully slow banjo roll with the halftime rock and roll rhythm of James Taylor. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really, really, really neat the way. So Hartford was fitting in on that stuff a little bit. Before you know it, he was fitting that too.
Yeah, his music is so cool. We do a few of those. We do Back in the Good Old Days. We do Morning Bugle, which is on the record. Really cool cut. So really, really cool instrumentals on that record too. There's two of them, Down and John McLaughlin, which is really cool. Cool choices and just weird. I mean, like the spirit of his music, it just comes through. It's so free. It's so kind of playful, or, you know, it's just inspiring to hear. I love it.
Well, and yeah, and when he, I mean, we used to, in riding around, we would listen, one of the records we listened to quite often was Birds of Fire by the Mahavishnu Orchestra. So back then, there'd be a lot of themes of bon, Anyway, one day Hartford says, yeah, I wrote one of those tunes like John McLaughlin does. That's great. What do you call it? He says, John McLaughlin.
John McLaughlin. I love it.
Okay.
That's so, really cool. We'll get right back to my interview with Sam Bush after this very short break.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
But yeah, he was open, and it's kind of wild how sometimes I find myself too appreciating more the old time stuff I grew up with more than I might have 30 years ago or something. So that John, as he aged, he got really more enamored with the old time fiddle stuff that would have been some of the first stuff he ever learned. And he really, really towards that at the end, the last five so years of his life was really, you know, or more than that, just immersed in fiddle tunes and writing them down and playing all the different ones and everything. But he just went, you know, went from his main focus, really banjo, and he was always a fiddler, but he really went way into it.
I remember seeing him toward the very end of his life, and I didn't get into bluegrass until a lot later than a lot of my peers, and I started going to Gray Fox, and I remember seeing him at Gray Fox, and I knew who he was, but I didn't quite have the grasp of the importance of John Hartford, the gravity of his music. But of course I knew who he was. We went down to see him play, and I remember he was playing fiddle and gently humming along. Every line that he was playing on the fiddle, you could hear him kind of humming into the mic as he was playing, you know, and there was this just synchronicity between his musical soul and what was coming out of his instrument. And it was very simple, but it was very beautiful. And, you know, he wasn't playing quite at like full strength like he was for so much of his career, because he has some really challenging and fast and crazy music, but it was just very beautiful and really poetic, and we were so lucky to get a chance to see him live.
Part of that, sometimes he'd be humming along, he'd be hunting for the oddball harmony, hunting along to a double stop, and it definitely got all of was influenced by Vassar, who was the ultimate king. Vassar could hum you an oddest third part to anything he could play, and it was an amazing feat to hear Vassar do. So John was always fascinated by what Vassar could do in that way.
Well, his influence obviously passed down to you, and then you guys have had such a big influence on our generation of pickers. And one of the records that is so incredibly influential is Strength in Numbers. And after NGR wrapped up, pretty much right around the time that NGR was wrapping up, you guys did Strength in Numbers. And it has gone on to become one of the most seminal records for all the musicians of my generation. When you guys were making that record, tell me a little bit about the process, because it wasn't a band. I mean, it was this collection of unbelievable musicians, but how did that come to be? How did the songs come to be? And then, you know, how did it ultimately go down in terms of recording the album?
Well, the way it got together and is that this little fellow with his bass named Edgar moved to Nashville. And so we all, the other four of us had kind of moved here, of course, to be either country or bluegrass, the nature of the thing. Edgar, we're not sure why he moved here, they used to have a thing called this Nashville Summer Lights Festival, and Edgar Meyer assembled us the first time to play some tunes he wrote and we were called Edgar Meyer and Friends. So we were first Edgar Meyer and Friends, and then he seemed like on his, when they had for a while the MCA Master Series, that was a division of MCA, and it got to be the artistic instrumental kind of section of where, you know, people were making instrumental records. Jerry did, you know, and Edgar did for MCA Master Series.
Okay.
And so that's what Strength in Numbers ended up on. That was the correct home for us on MCA Master Series. But Edgar put us together first. And then when he recorded his first record for them, he put the five of us together. It was really Edgar's thought that we do have a guitar, and its name is Jerry, right? So, you know, we do have a guitar. Plus, we had two excellent guitar. Bale is a very fine guitar player. And Mark O'Connor, of course, is a masterful guitarist. And so we had, you know, when we wanted a guitar, we had two guitars. But anyway, we started playing some jobs like that. Then we played a couple times at Telluride, and we started calling us the Telluride All-Stars, Well, we're not the only people on that festival. Some other people might go, hey, wait a minute. Why are they the All-Stars? And why? Wait a minute. So anyhow, we wanted to call the band Telluride, and we found out that there was a band that also was not from Colorado that already had copyrighted the name. But we could buy it for a nominal fee, and we said, well, we were thinking of calling the album Strength in Numbers. So that just became, that seemed like the right title for the band. But when we got it going, we realized that it would be really easy for us to just throw a jam session and just have fun playing. Mm-hmm. But what did we want? What were we trying to accomplish in doing this together? And the way I recall it was Bela and Mark that realized that if each person co-writes a song with the other four people, as a five-piece band, we have 10 totally co-written tunes.
Very cool.
So that's what we did. And the other ones could not turn down the ones that, you know, you two may have come up with that day that you go, hey, everybody, and nope, you had to play it. And so that's how me and Edgar got Pink Flamingos played. they couldn't turn us down.
Well, it's a classic. It's a classic. What was it like during the sessions? Do you feel like you guys had a sense that this was really something special?
It just felt great to me as we did it. I mean, we were meticulous about it, very meticulous, because,
like, in the rehearsing and learning of the songs, you mean? Yeah,
we were ready to go when we got there. We weren't working this stuff up in the studio. It was made to go together. I mean, there's quite a few songs where Edgar and I definitely we would organize every downbeat, every upbeat as to where we think they were going to go. And because we wanted it to feel kind of like lack of a better term on my part, like bluegrass chamber music or something, you know, where each part, because it seemed like there was a couple of tunes too where nobody really does hit on the same beat much. So, I mean, we just tried different ways of playing our instruments, and that was the good part about the co-writes of bringing in the different influences and the same, you know, the way Jerry writes, not at all the way, you know, Edgar would. And you have Edgar's classical sense of starkness, of when it's really okay for these real stark sounds just to stand. You don't have to fill up everything. That's where Edgar really can really shine.
Yeah, that's cool. I feel like each of you guys brings a very distinct voice and a very distinct concept about how the music should sound to that record, and that's why it's really stood the test of time. And in some way, it's kind of, you know, you mentioned Telluride. In some way, that record was the advent of kind of the core of the Telluride, you know, what's going on to become the Telluride house band. On this episode, I think we'll be airing after Telluride this year, but it's the 50th year of Telluride Bluegrass, and we've got the king of Telluride on the line. Amazing. Right here. So I have to ask, what has that festival meant to you over the years?
Well, I mean, if we were even looking around this, you know, looking around our house, I mean, for me, everything. I mean, I've literally grown up going there once a year, and I now know, God, how young I was when we first went, I mean, I don't take it for granted, because figuratively, it's given me a place to go, an audience to play to. But more than that, a lot of personal and musical relationships have been formed there. People I met there that I might not have met otherwise, maybe we didn't jam together then, but it could have led to something else later, or just, you know, the music that I've gotten to hear. You know, tonight I heard Paco de Lucia with his dancers, and holy mackerel, you know. I mean, there's just been some amazing things. But, I mean, it means everything to Lynn and me. I mean, and, you know, right down to, like, you know, we have quite a collection of Willie Matthews' beautiful posters from Telluride. So that's, but I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean, that any festival has gone on that long. So credit, you know, Craig and Steve and Planet Bluegrass, and keep, I mean, that, what an amazing feat to keep to any festival at all going, you know, much less one in you know, in the old Box Canyon there. And
I know it's not an easy place to get to. It's not an easy place to get to. And it's sort of like, it's a funny thing with the fans. You sort of see, you know, people who go to Telluride, they go every year, you know, and it's a tough nut to crack. It's a tough ticket to get. But if for the people who are in, it's like, you cannot miss this. And I think, you know, we feel so lucky, the String Dusters, to have been brought into that family. And like you say, it's just this reunion of all your people and people you've met at Telluride and all the other bands. And it's just such a special thing. And we can't wait to be there this summer. It's going to be great.
There's some years, you know, obviously we know more people than others. But I mean, when we all got started, we, the Newgrass Revival, were the first band that was hired not from Colorado. So the first year they had it was locals. They were all either Aspen or around Telluride, and the original band, who were the promoters, the Fall Creek Band. Cooster McAllister was the banjo picker in the band, Fred Shellman guitar, and John Herndon guitar. And so they started because they wanted some of their favorite bands to play there. So they heard the Newgrass Boys at Winfield in 74, and then they hired us in 75 to come out. And you know, we almost didn't make it. Courtney didn't want to go just for one job all the way to Colorado, so we actually broke up for a couple of days, but we got back together and went out to Telluride. We had the time of our life. We met some of our best friends for life. And then so, you know, we in turn, you know, now, you know, we told Peter Rowan about it. We told Brian Bowers about it, and Stevie.
Oh, so you guys kind of came back and spread the word. You guys kind of spread the word about this place you'd been. Okay.
We've been to the mountain.
Okay. We've
been
cool.
to the mountain. And so, but, and also, well, I mean, I'm not going to take, like, only because we said it, but I mean, you know, our manager was, and booking agent was Keith Case. Well, he was Hartford's too. So he told, you know, John, well, the Newgrass Boys went there and had the time of their life, you know, if you want to go. And Doc and Merle, you know, heard about it from us. They definitely did hear about it from us. And it, but it's, as you know, and it's a challenge to play there as one ages, I now know, it can be a challenge. The altitude is its own kind of thing. It, you know, depending on the song, in hillbilly terms, you really need to leave a song with a swaller in place, because boy, it's hard to catch a breath. And sometimes, you're, And you know, your instruments sound different up there at that altitude. They sound thinner. It affects banjos. It's not just wood. It affects everything. Strings go dead quicker. Hard to catch your breath. Can't slide on your strings as well. It's just dust. And that's if it has rained that day. So,
yeah, right.
You know, and it might be 90 in the day and 40 at night. And welcome to Telluride.
Could be snowing.
It has been for us.
Could be snowing.
Yes, I think almost everybody's had a Telluride snowing experience. Or it's dang near cold enough to. So it's its own challenge, but it's its own reward too. I still get kind of, you know, a certain feeling, you know, when we first hit town again. It's kind of hard to believe we made it.
Well, one of the things that we love about it is that the house band has become this staple, you know, and you guys, so Sam, Jerry Douglas on dobro, Stuart Duncan, Edgar, and then of course Bela and Brian Sutton, who have both been guests here on the podcast, get together for a set of music that, and it's evolved over the years now. I love how you guys are really just have fun with it, and it can be, you know, the craziest, most technical tunes to the most jovial stuff. And now, like, for example, we get some Bela Fleck lead vocals happening in recent years, and which sounds great. It all sounds great, and it's just, it's cool for us because of the inspiration that you guys have been, and we get a chance to see you guys every year, and it's really, really cool, and I'm excited for the summer. So I want to ask you really quick before we wrap up here. This has been so great and so fun to hear all these stories and sort of how this whole thing unfolded, but I did want to pick your brain a little bit just about kind of performance mindset and the things that you've honed in on over your career that you feel like have helped make you a better performer. Because I know that one impression that we, our generation, have of you, and this honestly came from, you know, when you came to do the Bluegrass Generals with us in Denver, I remember we were reminiscing after the fact about how, you know, it's 2 p.m. and you're rehearsing in a dark green room, and it's like, man, you're giving the music everything. And it feels like there's a real commitment to the music. I heard the same thing from Bela when he was a guest here, and just sort of giving it everything to the music, and, you know, as much as you possibly can. And that's really inspirational. But I wanted to hear from you. Just what are some thoughts about things that help you get in the zone, things you've worked on over the course of your career that have made you a better performer?
I tend to, and I can't, you can't always follow any one rule for starters, but I tend to really appreciate where I'm getting to be. Health wise, I've had the rug pulled out from under me a few times, and all of a sudden you go, oh, what if I don't get to do this anymore? Well, so, but I've always had a deep appreciation for getting to do it. I grew up on a farm. I know what real work is, and I'm not doing it. That being said, I think part of it, I come from an old time kind of way. When I grew up, you know, playing like in square dance bands, and being the youngest kid in the bluegrass band, you know, being the kid fiddler, and everybody else would be, you know, an adult. And you basically, you know, you shut the hell up, you stand there with a smile on your face, and you try to never let the audience know anything's wrong, you know. And the last thing in the world when you are in the audience is to hear some singer or player bitching about how cold their fingers are or how tough it is to breathe at the Telluride. I mean, you know what I mean? The last thing, I mean, shut up and enjoy playing and singing, because, you know, it is a privilege to get to play music. I mean, one we've worked for, you know, it's the reward, but you're not, and my mom said it, you know, this is coming from a mother from the, you know, that grew up on the farm. You're not special just because you know how to play an instrument. So, you know, keep that in mind. But really, I mean, it really does come back to old time show business I've grown up with that, you know, getting to play music on stage, that is the positive part of the day. That is your good part. And, yeah. And of course everything can't always be wonderful, but you can give it a good college try. And, if I go to a baseball game or a movie or a musical event, if I think about other things I should be doing, I'm not entertained enough. So, you know, I realize that we're entertaining through our music also. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if we can keep people's attention just by playing music, we don't have dance routines. But sure, it's fun to jump around a little bit, but not really choreographed. So, you know, if we can keep their attention by playing music, then we've done our jobs.
Yeah, and sometimes it takes a little intention and effort to stay with that gratitude. Like sometimes you just get a little in your own way and you get too much thinking about how you're doing or how you're doing that night or how that last solo was. And if you can just kind of zoom out big picture and be grateful for where you're at and what you're able to do, that can really help get you in the zone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard, you know, it's sometimes hard to keep that in perspective, right, when you're standing on stage and you're, because, you know, you let's face it, you don't always play to your own satisfaction as well as you wanted to execute something, and, you know, and, but...
you got to let it go.
You got to let it go, because guess what? You got some more stuff. You got some more notes you better try to play. You better forget about those. A live Emmy Lou Harris record came out a couple of years ago from now, you know, well over 25 years ago when we did it. And I just barely, I kind of had a memory that night of I knew it was being taped, but nothing ever was said about it. And then all of a sudden they found the tapes and I listened to it. And I remembered that night not being real happy with my playing. And then when now over 25 years later, you're listening to a tape of it going, wow, I wish I could mess up like that now.
So that's awesome.
You know, keep it in perspective. You
that's
know?
Right. That's right. Well,
it's just music. Have fun with it, and just, you know, if we miss it today, we'll try again tomorrow.
Wise words, and a great, great spot, I think, to wrap it up here with one of the best to ever do it. Sam Bush, my man, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thanks, man. It's my pleasure.
Thanks, Sam. All right, that's a wrap on episode 36 of the podcast. Too cool to be hanging out with Sam Bush today. Oh, just one of the all-time legends. Sam, we thank you. And I thank all of you for tuning in to Inside the Musician's Brain. We are brought to you by Osiris Media, Americana Vibes, and Deering Banjos, your source for everything banjo. If you would please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. Let the world know what we got going on over here and let them know that you dig it. It helps a ton. And I got to say, we got some very, very exciting guests coming up for the end of this season. I'm not even sure who's up next. I'm going to figure that out here in the coming days. I got to get my bags packed and get out the door for String Dusters Tour, but I'll catch you all again right here in 2 weeks when we go back inside the musician's brain.
Osiris.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today, such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music. And I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts. And new episodes come out every Monday.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.